Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com video presentation. So, more on photons, I think. There's just so many little subtle details, blah blah blah. It's really a good subject, sort of related to the slit experiments, partially, blah blah blah. And I also got a comment from Telephone Bill, who seems to be, has some electronic equipment anyway, so yeah, maybe he can do some experiments. So we'll see. I think this is good, very good. It debunks a lot of woo-woo. I'll try some experiments to try to confirm the idea that there may be infrared stuff between the light and dark visible patterns. So, yeah, the only trick is, there's always a trick, unfortunately. There's these little subtle details that just, make it more complicated than it'd be very nice if it was simple. It's like the difference between the photoelectric effect and the photoelectric effect. That is the idea that you can cast light on something and create electricity in the conductor, a photodiode, for example, and the idea that there's a photoelectric effect where you actually shoot electrons off a surface and how fast they're going. So those two things really aren't the same thing. I mean, obviously ejecting electrons is different than moving electrons. So the electric part is moving. When you eject, that's something more than electric. There should be another term for it, is all I'm saying. And I'm just saying there's a lot of that little subtlety that's lost in the vague language that physics has created to describe these effects. And that's irritating. It's like the nature of heat. Is heat infrared radiation, or is heat, some other phenomenon in an object, and the infrared radiation is just a consequence or a symptom of the real phenomenon, which is the fact that the electrons are moving on the surface. That kind of stuff can't, there's a distinction, and it's sort of important. So, we'll probably do some drawing, so we'll need that. Alright, so the first one kind of relates to the part two of the Susskind video, where he was just getting to the point where he's arguing that you could turn a photon off. So you have one slit open, and then you have a pattern, and there's places that are light. And you open another slit, and those places become dark. Now, the argument is that probably doesn't really happen, because what really happens when you bring the second slit in, you're bringing two more surfaces in, and you're quadrupling the probability of making a photon. So you have four times as much light, which means a place that looked previously like it was a light spot now will look like a dark spot if something next to it is very bright. And you can sort of see that in the double slit patterns, is that the bands between the light spots aren't completely dark spots. And if you just turn the light down, you can make the difference between those things less and less distinct or obvious. And so it's really an on and something that's on four times as much. And that difference can be deceptive. So we don't really have any experiments, of course, so there's, you really can't argue the evidence because it really doesn't exist. The only thing close was one video by a Christian Scientist type person, where they were using a filter that filtered out all the photons that came too close together, and that's sort of cheating. So anyway, so the point I wanted to make is understanding the concept of the frequency's importance, we're just going to say, look, whether you want to believe in waves or particles, doesn't really matter. This would be the crest of the waves, would be the clumpy part. The part that matters is the on part, and the off part, part where there is no lump, hump, that's, we're calling one the on part and the off part. There's no such thing, I would argue, as a positive and then a truly negative. It was just on and off, and it's a relative on and off. This could be 1,000,000 and this could be 500. It's just making a distinction. there's a difference between this area in space and this area in space, in the sense that there's more here and less here. That's all you really need is an example of a pattern that is detectable. Now, the question is, okay, so all this is moving the speed of light. I think I'm going to sneeze. All right, take a pause so I can sneeze. Ah, that was rather pleasant. We're back? Yeah, we're back. All right. So, this stuff is moving the speed of light in a direction, and the frequency, is set by the fact that the speed they're going and the speed of arrival. So one arrives at a different time than the other one, than the next one. And I'm going to argue that, okay, let's say it's a minimum number, a photon is 3 of these things. Yeah. But that's just a minimum. So the idea is you could have such a thing as a blue photon, okay, and photons, yeah, photons in the sense that where you make a distinction, you know, if I have 6 of these going in a row, is it 2 photons or is it 1 photon? You know, because a photon can just be a certain amount of energy hitting the spot. The fact that there's another photon doing exactly the same thing right behind it, you know, you could argue is a possibility. And it's really going to be 2 photons. You know, they're just going to be following each other. All right. So the trick is that there's an aspect of this photon called polarization, which I can illustrate as, you know, just a lack of alignment, you know, that the photons are in a pattern. So one's here, you know, the top. So you could be traveling through space this way. You know, the middle is the second one and the bottom is the third one. And they're in alignment with each other in one dimension. But they don't have an alignment in the other dimension. And so that's a photon hits a surface where it's like an airplane shooting bullets on the ground. The bullets hit in sequence in a row going forward. And that's how a photon's hitting a surface. And the idea is that this distance, that is the polarization, how much they're out of alignment, okay, is a consequence of, you know, is proportional to the wavelength. So whatever the wavelength is between two of these, this ends up being, in some respect, proportional. I would say, you know, whatever, equal or half, we don't know. I haven't gone through all the details to scrutinize that as a fact one way or the other. So we'll just say it's some amount that's close to and it's related to. So the question is why is it related? So that gets to the question of what's a photon doing when it hits a surface. All right. So the idea is that we know this frequency, let's just call it 500 nanometers for the sake of making it simple. This frequency is rather large. It's a pretty good distance between these two objects. And so the idea is that what has to happen when they're hitting the surface is you kind of have to understand that the surface is atoms. And you're saying in 500 nanometers, you know, I can fit 1,000 atoms in there. Well, let's say at least 5. No, it's probably 1,000. An average atom would be 0.5. So obviously 0.5 into 500,000. So, you know, so you have 1,000 atoms that somehow is going to receive a polarization. You know, that huge polarization kind of indicates it has to hit over 1,000 atoms. You know, something close to that. Something in that range. And that there's a, you know, 1,000 atoms between the hits. So you can kind of logically understand that the photon being able to interact with a single electron doesn't seem very probable that all of this stuff with that great deal of distance between them could all hit exactly in the same tiny minute spot in space on an electron, and that you'd have to believe that the first one didn't move it someplace where you can't hit it with the second one. So you have to come up with a theory that kind of recognizes that photon is an atomic thing. You know, it's not so, you know, it needs to be created by atoms, and it needs to be, you know, absorbed by atoms. that it's not just a single electron makes a little squiggly that pops out and they call it photon. It just isn't going to be, the real answer isn't, in my opinion, going to be that simple. That a single electron can't really do it. Because it can't create the polarization. It can't jump from here to here in the time required. Just can't cover that much distance to eject a bit from a different location. So the idea would be is that the energy is really just hitting a different atom. So I've sort of argued that all the electrons, you know, are kind of in set positions with the, you know, nucleuses of the, well, let's make these X's, and then so the X's are protons. And the idea is electrons are in positions, and what you're really going to do is you're going to create energy, you're going to hit an electron, and that's going to cause other electrons, okay, that are in the matrix to also move. So when you hit this electron, you know, on a surface, you're moving electrons this way and this way, this way and this way. You know, you're moving electrons in all the ways that they're physically connected. So you're kind of creating a wave. So in a sense, you hit one electron in a spot, and it pushes in, and that pushes every other electron out. So in a sense, all the electrons that are connected to that one electron you hit with energy, they also move, and they move in a direction, away. So they're all moving out. And then what's really going to happen is at the speed of light or the speed of electricity, you have pressure moving in all these directions. So I could draw it as a wave, you know, little wave going, a wave of energy. But it's really made of discrete electrons moving. They're all moving out. And the idea is the next one's going to hit. And so the next one hits, let's say, here. So the first one hit here. The next one could be at any direction. The polarization could be in any direction. But the idea is it really is going to be polarized in the sense that the next one's going to hit here. And it's going to hit there at just the right timing because of this frequency. That at the speed of light, that's how far the energy has moved in the sense that you're behind the electron that you've already pushed. So you've pushed these electrons, they're moving. And now you're going to hit right behind them, you know, based on the frequency, and push them again. But you're obviously not going to be pushing this one forward, or this one forward, or this one forward, or this one. So all the other ones you moved, you're not going to add energy to any of those. You're only really going to be adding energy to this one, but you hit behind in this orientation. Now, you might be able to hit here and push both of these a little bit, but that's the only alternative. And if it's made out of three components, that is, if you have to have a minimum of three hits, you know, two, three, to increase the speed, and that's all you're really saying you want to do. So you want to just take an electron in the matrix of the atoms, and you're really saying I need to make it go faster so I can make it electric. That is, I can take electrons, if I give them enough speed, I can force them to jump between each other. But if I don't give them enough speed, they won't jump, right? So you have to dissipate you have to put enough energy in to cause the electrons to create a stream of interactions, dominoes. You have to get the dominoes to fall over. And you need a certain minimum amount of energy to cause that cascade. And if you don't get that speed, you don't get the cascade. All you get is a wobble. So these just wobble. These electrons don't get enough speed to move to the next atom, and they just move back to their position. So they all go back. All right, but this one doesn't go back because you hit it again behind it. So in a sense, you could say a photon needs two things, because you just need that second hit, and that'll create polarization in the sense that obviously this is polarized. You didn't go in every direction, you just went in one direction. So the polarization is essentially dictating which way you're making the little piece of electric current go. But that's the idea. So I would say it takes three, so that's my present theory. And what you really have to do is hit it a third time. So now that you have energy moving in this direction, you have to have a third time behind it. And that's where the polarization comes in, is that if you get the polarization too crooked, there's no chance you'll end up behind this one to push it. So if it ends up hitting over here, you know, the second one hit here, the third one hits out here, but it always has to be further out because of the polarization. That's not going to do you any good. That's not going to make this electron move fast enough to start knocking, to start hopping. So you can think of electricity as hopping between atoms. So you have to have a minimum amount of speed, something less than the speed of light, but something pretty fast, to be able to cause the cascade, where one electron just pops into the other next atom, and then it pushes another electron out of that atom into the next atom, and the electron just keeps hopping. That's electricity. So that's the photoelectric effect, in the sense of that's the effect that a photodiode is acknowledging. So the photodiode is recognizing that you're throwing energy in, you're creating, okay, this cascading of electrons, and you can measure the plus and minus effect of moving those electrons. All right. Yeah, I think that's okay. So you have to understand that the atoms are in crystals, which are in domains, you know, so it, I mean, it gets a little more complicated, but you have to understand, you know, the atoms really are in a form of crystals, all right? And the crystals have a shape, and the shapes have to connect to each other, and where the electricity is really in between the lines of the crystal. So the electricity will really follow the path of the fissures between the crystals. So it doesn't matter which way. Once the material polarizes, then it will decide which one is negative and which one is positive. But all the electricity you create in all kinds of different polarized angles will all end up being, will all be directed by the crystal in one direction or in the other direction, depending on what the polarization of the crystals are. But anyway, that's getting into the chemistry, and it's a little more complicated, and so, you know, I won't speculate that far. So that's how you create electricity in a substance. Now, the photoelectric effect needs, essentially, the reason why the cutoff is ultraviolet, that is, you need something more than, say 350 nanometers. You need something smaller, you know, half the size of the red light, to be able to cause enough velocity to actually eject electrons off the surface. So the idea is the same. It's that you're hitting them before they slow down at all. So say when the first hit comes in, the electron's moving faster and then its velocity is degrading. So it has a high velocity and then the velocity starts slowing down and you hit it again. And then you give it a push. So you have the new velocity, which will be this, plus the velocity you still have. And that's why you're increasing the velocity. And ideally, the sooner you hit behind it, the sooner you hit it, the more velocity it still has. So then you have a big V plus a bigger V, but it's a big V already. And so to eject it, you need these Vs to stay big. So you have to, so the sooner you hit it, so you're hitting it and then you're hitting it again, okay, before it's lost much of its energy. And then essentially you're hitting it again. Now you're not hitting the same electron, might not be anyway. You're just hitting electrons that are being pushed. So ones that are being caused to move because there was, you know, a little earthquake, and you're just pushing, there's a seismic wave moving through and the particles are all moving out, and you're just picking any one of them to say, I'm going to push you some more. And so the idea is you're pushing it sooner before it's lost its velocity. And so you're giving it more and more velocity, getting closer and closer to maybe the speed of light. And then the electron is going fast enough where instead of knocking the dominoes over, it bounces off the domino. It essentially can't push the next electron. It's going too fast. And the other electron can't move at that velocity because it's in pressure with a bunch of other electrons. It's tied to all these other electrons. It can't move all of those electrons fast enough. So this one just bounces off. So the electron goes in and just bounces off the field created by that matrix of electrons it can't push because it needs to do it slower. Can't push it at the fast velocity. So it bounces out. And so the higher the frequency, that is the faster the little bits are coming, the closer they are, the impacts, the more velocity. So the more velocity you give this electron that's going to move into this field of electrons, the more energy you give it in flying out. So if you hit it with gamma rays, then you'll have an electron that flies out really far. You hit it with just barely ultraviolet, then you know the electron barely gets off the surface. So the higher the frequency, the faster, the higher the velocity of the electron you eject. So I'm just saying there's a big difference between the electrical phenomenon and this kind of charge phenomenon where you're actually ejecting electrons off the surface, you know, just taking them away and sending them in space, so to speak. Now the odds are they'll go back down here again. Okay, in most cases, you'll only be able to eject them. They will, you know, be degraded by the fact that this is still a positive surface, in the sense that the nucleuses are producing more density, and therefore their charge is a little stronger than the spread out electrons, and so surfaces from a distance will always look positive to anything. And so the electron will be essentially gravitationally or charged by through charge will be pulled back in to the surface. Now you can also set it up where you create a very strong field repelling the electrons. So you create a negative field out here and you just push the electrons back into the surface. And that's how they measure the strength of the light, is by measuring how strong the how fast the electron's moving and whether it's fast enough to actually jump from one surface to another. Okay, but that's more complex than you need, and I probably need to erase this to say anything more. So we're going to get to this crystal idea, you know, where you put blue light in and you get red light out. Technically you don't. See, unfortunately the numbers are too close. Like you could say blue is 350 and you could say that red was 7. And it's just barely possible. Barely visible, barely visible. So the real point is you just kind of have to use ultraviolet or invisible light, you know, in the high frequency, and then you'll get visible photons back. But you can't, strictly speaking, have visible photons in and get visible photons out by separating the frequency. You know, by simply, I mean, it's really kind of a simple process. You're just basically saying, I'm going to turn photons that are this close together into a stream of photons that'll be this close together. So I'm basically going to send one, these three, I'll interact and they'll go this way, and these three, well, I didn't draw the other one, will go that way. So that's all you're really doing. You're just saying that I'm going to hit an electron in such a way, or an atom, that it's going to turn as I hit it, and then the next one's going to flip it back the other way, and the next one's going to flip it back the other way. So it's going to keep turning which way, when you hit it, which way it moves. And it's just going to keep flipping. And so when one hits, it goes left, and then and it swings over, and the next one hits, it goes right. And then it swings over, and the next one hits, goes left. So you can just understand that if, when you're hitting it this way, it wants to get back to where it was, so it curves the line and straightens up and then moves back. And then you hit it again and it goes, does the opposite. So it's just it's like on a watch or something else. It's a little ticker that just ticks back and forth. And that's all you need to break a piece of blue light into two pieces of red light. You have the same amount of energy. You know, you have 6 units of the blue, and then you end up with 3 and 3 in terms of the units of the red. So I might not need much more, might just keep it here. I don't know if there's any other, well, I'll think about it, I'll pause and see if there's some other aspect. But I'm just saying, so it is a little complicated. So I guess what I'll talk about is how you detect if this is true and what the obstacles are. All right, probably should just reinforce an idea that I've been saying for years, is that when they talk about the energy of a photon, they're being really deceptive in the sense of talking about how blue photons have more energy, because how they have the more energy doesn't really have anything to do with their something intrinsic. They're not moving faster. They're not bigger pieces of something. So the point that needs to be made is that if you have, you know, this arrangement, and all you do is change the frequency, that is, you make them closer together, you don't change the energy of these individual bits. But what you do is change their capacity to make something happen. So it's a tipping point argument. If I want to tip something over, all right, and I hit it with something and it moves, well, if I don't hit it again while it's moving in that direction, I won't effectively be able to add the energy. So the only way I can add the energy is I have to make sure it's moving in this direction when I hit it. If I hit it when it's moving in this direction, I'm going to be out of luck. I'm going to cancel, essentially, you know, not destroy, but I'm going to just cancel the capacity of this thing to move based on what's happening. I can't give it the energy. I'm going to reflect the energy effectively. And so blue light obviously has a better capacity to add more energy to a system because it's more likely to hit it before it's slowed down. Okay, obviously as it tips, it's going to slow down. It's going to lose its energy because there's going to be this tension here to not break, right, with the ground, right? You're tipping it here, and it's this gravity essentially that's pushing it back up, okay? So because you're trying to move you're gravitationally lifting part of the object, and the object wants to go back. Well, electrons are in the same kind of tension. They're attracted to a proton, repelled by the other electrons, and they want to tip back to their position. Their native condition is to be in a balanced, you know, equalized position. And if you hit them, you're knocking them out of what they already said was, this is the comfortable place. This isn't comfortable, I'd already be there. This isn't comfortable, I'd already be there. This is the place where my forces are balanced. So they want to get back to being balanced. So the idea is, if I hit them with blue, higher frequency light, I'm more likely to hit it while it's moving actually faster in this direction. You know, so it's tipping and it's still moving at a good velocity. And now I'm adding more velocity and then more velocity. So if I want to tip something over, frequency, how often I hit something is really important. You can know that in your real life. You have to throw the things, you have to have the impact at the right time to cause the effect. And that's essentially why blue light has the capacity, the energy to do something. It's merely because of the frequency. It has nothing to do with the actual energy. That is, the total energy it contains isn't more. What's more is the fact that the time in which it's delivering that energy is different. And time is energy in some respects. All right, so there's a possible syndrome where you could say, okay, let's send 10 gigahertz signal. And the idea would be is that these signals from two places would have overlaps. So this is the, you know, constructive and destructive interference kind of argument. Right, that you can draw these path lengths and get different places where they'd be in phase and out of phase. So we're just talking about in phase and out of phase. Again, it's just this. It's just, you know, either they're lined up or they're not lined up. And that's in phase and out of phase. So if you thought of these as pieces and you were just sending pieces out, okay, that were in phase, that all the pieces came out at the same time. And what you're saying is if I make the path length for one of these arms longer, what I'm going to do is mean that they can't land at the same time anymore. They're out of sequence with each other. But if I make the line a little bit longer, then they're back in sequence. So you're just saying, I'm just adjusting it to keep, you know, this, you know, stopping this from happening, you know, where they're out of sequence. Now, the key is there be a certain point where they're exactly, you know, where we're doing the opposite of taking blue light and turning it into two red lights, where we'd have the syndrome where we're actually creating, we're taking two reds and making a blue by putting one of the reds exactly, you know, 90 degrees out of phase. You know, whatever this is, I think it's 90. So by putting them 90 degrees out of phase, we get them to be exactly 180 degrees. Well, whatever. It doesn't really matter too much, right? You get the idea. Right in the middle of the other phase. And so, you know, technically we would have made blue light. But the trick is, right, one trick is that the polarization of the blue light, you know, is really small compared to the red light. It has, you know, its variance in terms of, you know, it lands much on a much straighter line than red light. Red light has a lot more capacity to be out of alignment. And so that's one question is whether, you know, the two reds would have big polarization. They can't really composite into something with smaller polarization. You can't undo the sloppiness of the two reds, right? They're too spread out, and you can't make them have the fine, you know, straightness of the blue photon. So you're not going to end up with a, you know, making two reds into a blue by putting them out of phase. But the real question is the energy question. So this is one where, you know, this test might be, so I'm just saying it might not be very likely that you could take 10 gigahertz and then have a detector for 20. So you have perfect tens coming out, and you want to detect at places where this one would be a half wavelength out of alignment with this one. So it's one half of a wavelength. And so then here, you should have the possibility of collecting that 20 gigahertz signal, because you've combined two tens out of alignment and created a 20. But it'll be a tiny location where it's perfect. And the question is does the polarization make it impossible to do? Because you're taking two widely polarized objects and trying to make something that's narrowly polarized. And that might not be possible. All right, so the other question is the thermodynamic question. So if I'm correct, you know, sources, like in the two slit experiment, are, well, I can draw on top of this. Yeah, you can almost see it. Almost. All right, so like in the two slit experiment, you're hitting and there's these locations that are light and dark, okay? So you're creating a pattern of bands of where there's a photon and where there's no photon. Now, I'm arguing that all of the locations are being hit by the same number of bits. So the same number of these little things are hitting every location. And all that's happening is where they're in phase, you've remade a visible photon that we can detect because it has the right frequency. And where they're out of phase, that is where you end up with something like this, you know, where these two are this frequency and these two are a different frequency. So it can't be, it's not hitting here and then here and then here to push something. It's hitting off, which is way behind it or way in front of it even. You know, if you're rolling a ball and you hit it with stuff and then you hit ahead of it, that's not going to do you any good at all. So you always have to hit behind it. So if you have a frequency in inconsistency, it means the ball won't be at this location and you're going to be hitting a location the ball isn't at, and you're not going to be able to push it. All right, but the idea is the same amount of stuff is hitting all these locations. So even if it looks like a visible photon or it's an invisible photon, it still means that, you know, four of these things hit. So four of them hit here, and they hit in the right sequence to be a visible photon and reflected. Now, the fact that it reflected kind of, you know, is a problem thermodynamically, because we don't necessarily have then a heating of the surface. But it would be interesting, just because you're saying all the other stuff would probably get absorbed. But you can't, you know, you can't deny that some of it could be reflected, and we just can't detect it because we don't have detectors for uneven frequency. We can't detect gravity, right? So the stuff that's not coming at a frequency, we can't see it. So it's still energy, and it's still contributing to heat. And likewise, so anyway, so these spots are getting just as hot as the argument. But the question is if the stuff is going in and then being reflected as infrared, the problem is that the infrared is a symptom of when you mix it all together. So this inside surface is just going to mix all the energy that comes in, and it's going to reflect it evenly out. So you might not be able to detect the fact that there's still infrared, because you'll have the same amount as all the others. I think the answer is going to be yes. The pattern will disappear because you won't see any of the visible light with the infrared, and all of the surfaces will be radiating the same amount of temperature. But you can argue either theory, because you could just say, well, that's because the photons reflected. No. And so I guess the argument would be you have to do this on a very black surface, so there's no photons that are reflected, they're all absorbed. And then when you get the null result, that is, you get no pattern, it's going to be more conclusive that it doesn't matter whether you saw a visible photon, the same energy is hitting all the surfaces. So the idea is there's no destructive interference. There's just breaking a photon. So the idea is the slit just takes the photon, the pattern, and because it's polarized, it knocks some pieces off. Some pieces hit the surface, and then other pieces hit electrons near the surface and are deflected in different directions. And all you're really doing is saying, I'm just going to put the pieces back together. So I just take something that's a pattern, and I break the pattern, break the continuity, and throw them out. And the fact is, there's a 50-50 chance when they land, okay, that they'll be in phase or out of phase, because that's all that matters, is whether they're in phase or out of phase. And you have a 50-50 chance that you're making them closer to being in phase or closer to being out of phase. So it doesn't count as out of phase if I'm just a little bit off, right? If I have a little difference between this frequency and this frequency, that won't destroy the photon. I need more, and it's really just a 50-50 chance whether you're going towards being in phase or going towards being out of phase. And so it turns out that when you look at the actual pattern, you'll see that the light bands are always bigger than the dark bands. The dark bands are always smaller than the light bands, so it seems like there's quite a bit of fudging room where you'll still get a visible photon even though the frequency or the phase isn't very pure. So there's something, yeah, so the real truth is you don't destroy photons, you just take them and mix them up, and so in a sense break them, and then you just remake them. You just take a piece from this surface, and then a piece from this surface, and in the two slit, a piece from this surface and a piece from this surface, recreate the right timing. And then you have a photon. If they don't make the right timing, if two of them are close together and two of them are further apart, then you don't have a photon. So if they're in the right pattern, you get a photon. Wrong pattern, no photon. I suppose I could have drawn that in a better position, but whatever. A lot better. I'll have to pay more attention. But anyway, so that's probably enough. So, just pointing out that there's, all you need is two or three variables, two or three things you can vary, frequency, polarization. Yeah, you just need two, really. And you can create an awful complicated mess out of just those two variables in terms of matching them to a physical circumstance. But anyway, lots to work on there. But the conventional physics really doesn't have any theory of how photons work, how they create electricity, how they eject electrons. None of it makes much sense. They just say it does. And they really can't give you a rational diagram. I mean, they make up stories about how the electron is in a hole and you have to hit it with a certain energy to pop it out of the hole. None of that's true. And again, it seems quite obvious that what is happening is that we see photons by creating electricity in the substance. That's how we detect photons that are hitting something that don't reflect as photons, is that we detect them by the current they create on absorption. And that has to happen over numerous atoms. Electricity takes more than one atom to make. And So it's kind of clear that photons, although made of very tiny discrete objects, they are very large, and that's why they can be a mile long. Because that's just the distance between the little pieces of energy. All right. Yeah, that's enough. I mean, what makes this, what takes away, makes it a little less fun is the fact that, our eyes can only see this certain range, and it might be polarization that's creating the range, right? Our eyes can only detect certain polarization because our eyes are using little rods that are sticking up. And you can sort of understand to have a photon, it has to have a wavelength that can hit both rods. And if it can't hit both rods, then we don't see it. Those little simple geometric mechanisms, could be that simple, why we can't see higher frequencies. And then the reason why we can't see the lower frequencies, you come up with some other explanation that there's not enough energy because there's rods and the energy has to go around the surface of the rods, and you can never, it breaks the continuity, the flatness of the surface is broken, and therefore you can't push the electron along. Some kind of crap like that. And the fact is that when we're detecting all the other photons, we're doing it with radio receivers, essentially, tuners, and they can only tune in to very small, narrow bands of frequency. They can't differentiate, and so they can be jammed really easily. I can send a radio signal from one side and send it from another side, and the fact is, if they're in phase, okay, I can see a photon, but if they're out of phase, I can't pull this one out of the noise of this one. So the tuners are really subject to noise. The more noise there is, the less signal I can detect, because I'm superimposing the signal on other signals and they're just mixing, and I can't say which hand is which, kind of thing. Those are all unfortunate limitations. Okay, well, that's probably enough of a video. So this has been draftphysics.com and debatephysics.com, or not just and or video presentation. And till the next time and such.